Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
This episode of Global Journalist originally aired on October 25th, 2012.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The Journalism School presented this year's Missouri Honor Medal to 8 individuals for their distinguished service in journalism. One of those 8 individuals is Mona El-Tahawi, a columnist based in New York and an international public speaker on Arab and Muslim issues. She's joining us here in the Global Journalist Studio before the Honor Medal presentation to talk about her work and about the conditions in her home country, Egypt. Mona, welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Now, I notice you have your smartphone right in front of you there.
Well, I mean, this smartphone goes to sleep with me, so it's literally next to my pillow. So if I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm checking Twitter. First thing I do in the morning is check Twitter. I basically live on Twitter. It's my most immediate source of news. It keeps me connected to not just Egypt, but many other countries in the region and also across the US and other parts of the world. And usually a typical day is me tweeting my thoughts about a particular issue or theme that happens to concern me that day or that I'm angry about, and then retweeting people I follow who are tweeting interesting things or breaking stories of some kind that I and many others are trying to highlight and shed light on. So I basically just spend the entire day on Twitter and then do things in between.
Now, during a protest, street protest in Cairo last fall, you were photographing during the protest, and Egyptian riot police attacked you and beat you and so badly that they broke your arm and a bone in your hand, correct? And you spoke to the students earlier in the day about how Twitter saved your life. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I was on the front line of a clash with an activist friend of mine covering what was happening, and we were shot at, and so what ended up being infiltrators from the security side on our side of the clash entrapped us basically and held on to us until the riot police came. Mm-hmm. And they beat and arrested my friend and also beat and arrested me. They beat me, as you said, they broke my left arm and my right hand in two places. And they also sexually assaulted me and then took me to the Interior Ministry for 6 hours and military intelligence for 6 hours. Now, during the beating, I lost my phone. So I was in detention and very worried that nobody knew where I was. 3 hours into the detention in the Interior Ministry, I was kept in an office where people were coming and going, and two activists had come in to try to negotiate a truce to end the clash. One of them had a BlackBerry. He got me onto Twitter. I was able to tweet, "Beaten, arrested, Interior Ministry."
Wow.
And literally 5 or 10 seconds after it, his battery died. So basically, it really literally saved my life, because very soon after that, hashtag Free Mona was trending worldwide. Uh-huh. Al Jazeera and The Guardian picked it up, and the State Department said, "We're onto this." So people were helping to get me released.
Right. And just to put this in perspective, why you're such a large character, you were named Newsweek Magazine's 150 Fearless Women of 2012, one of Time Magazine's People of the Year, and one of Arab Business Magazine's 100 Most Powerful Arab Women. And lately you've been focusing on this, the importance of social media in the Arab world. So let's start there. You recently retweeted an article posted in on EgyptIndependent.com about a report from the Nadim Human Rights Center that detailed police abuses of human rights in Egypt. And the report said that during the first 100 days of President Mohamed Morsi's presidency, 88 people were tortured, 34 people were killed, and either on the streets or in police stations. And that made me wonder, you know, with your wide perspective, being from Egypt and following what's been going on in that country your whole life, are human rights better protected now than they were under Mubarak?
No. That is the short answer. And the long answer is no, because the revolution continues. The revolution is not finished. I mean, one of the sparks for the revolution was police brutality, because about 6 or 7 months before what was intended as a protest against police brutality, a young man was beaten to death in Alexandria, Egypt, a young man called Khalid Said, who has become one of the icons of the revolution now. Many people have been beaten to death in Egypt by police, but his death was one that sparked especially this generation that I a long time called Generation Facebook. Right. These young people basically who have embraced Facebook and social media. Now, they're just one of many groups in Egypt who are using social media to highlight these kind of abuses. And one of the most effective uses of social media has been that the way it's used by human rights groups like En Nedim. So when all these groups came together on January the 25th, they were essentially protesting police brutality on what is known in Egypt as Police Day. Mm-hmm. But when we look at the history, or the record, rather, the very tainted record of police brutality since then, it continues, which says to me that the revolution continues. It's by no means over, and we must continue the struggle until we achieve the kind of justice that was one of the reasons this revolution began.
Right. And we had Karim Al-Hakim on Global Journalist earlier this year. He's a co-director of the a documentary about the Egyptian revolution. They actually filmed the first 11 days of the revolution, and he called they called the movie Half Revolution. And he and his crewmates risked their lives to shoot footage of the protests in Tahrir Square, which you did later in the year. And you've seen the documentary?
Yes, I have. It's very good.
And you were you here in the States when those first days?
During the 18 days of the revolution, yes. I was in the U.S., yes.
Okay. And, and I'm bringing this up because the title of Half Revolution emphasizes, of course, like you've said, that the revolution is only partly finished. It also the documentary came to mind when I read a quote from the article you did for Foreign Policy magazine this summer, underneath the headline, very provocative, Why Do They Hate Us? The Real War on Women in the Middle East. And I wanted to see if you could just read this paragraph from the article, and then we can expand on it a bit.
Mm-hmm. An entire political and economic system, one that treats half of humanity like animals, must be destroyed, along with the other more obvious tyrannies choking off the region from its future. Until the rage shifts from the oppressors in our presidential palaces to the oppressors on our streets and in our homes, our revolution has not even begun.
So in a sense, when the documentary directors were talking about a half revolution, they were talking about the big picture, but you're saying that there needs to be a revolution that focuses on women.
I'm much more focused now, and this is one of the reasons that I'm moving back to Cairo. I'm going to relocate from New York to Cairo. I'm much more focused on the cultural revolution, because we started the political revolution, which Karim and his co-director call a half revolution, and they're absolutely right in that. That must continue. But in order for that political revolution to succeed, we must have a parallel and in tandem cultural revolution. The cultural revolution involves a social revolution, a sexual revolution, and a revolution that acknowledges once and for all that in the way that the regime oppressed everybody in Egypt, there are certain things in Egyptian culture and society, or Tunisian culture and society, or anything, all those are different cultures and societies within the region that specifically oppress women. So we're talking about women now fighting on two levels of revolution, a revolution against the regime. And when you look at a country like Egypt, the regime is still very much in place. All the institutions that the former regime put in place remain in place. So there's that revolution, but there's also the revolution of women against patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And patriarchy, not just with a big P, but patriarchy with a small P. So whether it's I call it the Mubaraks in our mind, right, and the Mubaraks in our living rooms, and the Mubaraks in our bedrooms. These are all Mubaraks, i.e. patriarchs in our minds, that stand in the way of women being full, active contributors to society.
Right. And you also went on in the article to give some personal anecdotes, including you talked about the female genital mutilation issue, and you talk about that and how it affected your family.
Right. In Egypt, unfortunately, female genital mutilation, which is, and it takes the form of various kinds of genital cutting, is very widespread. For women between the age of 35 and up, I believe the statistic is as high as 92%. And I found out about this very, very heartbreaking and horrifying practice when I discovered that it had happened, it had been my mother and five of her six sisters had been subjected to this horrific practice. And it's a practice that I often try to explain to people, that parents subject their daughters to, not because they hate them, but ironically enough, because they love them, because they understand that this is a cultural requirement in order for women to be accepted as quote-unquote good women, in order to be married, in order to be accepted socially. So it's something that many people have been fighting for a long time in Egypt, and is actually now criminalized. In 2008, it became a crime to contribute in any way to this form of genital cutting. But it's such a deeply rooted practice, right, among Muslims and Christians in Egypt. It's not about religion. Mm-hmm. It's a cultural practice that mostly covers a large swath of Eastern Africa. And it's also practiced in other countries, but very quietly, no one talks about it. And it's also traveled across as people have emigrated to different parts of the world. And essentially, it has to do with controlling women's sexuality. This is how you create, quote-unquote, good women. So one of the things that in Egypt we also have to focus on for this cultural revolution is fighting this harmful traditional practice that people justify, sometimes using religion and sometimes using the idea of purity. But at the end of the day, it's a harmful traditional practice that as part of our cultural revolution, we must fight against and eradicate in order for this revolution of women to succeed.
Right. And what are, say, two or three, kind of outline the other major issues that this revolution has to address?
I think the cultural revolution also has to address rights for everybody, regardless of who the majority is and who the minority is. So we're thinking about something that resembles a Bill of Rights as we have here in the U.S. I'm an Egyptian-American. I'm a dual citizen. And I very much appreciate this idea that we should not have a tyranny of the majority. People sometimes ask me, what if the majority of people in Egypt don't want women to have rights? And I think that's a really dangerous and nonsensical question, because rights should not be held hostage to a majority, whether they believe in a right or not. I think when we talk about rights, we should not stoop down to the lowest common denominator, but rather we should use rights to lift people up to this wonderful idea that everybody deserves rights, regardless if they're the majority or the minority. I think another thing we have to focus on is laws and what is enshrined in our laws. There are some laws in Egypt and other countries in the region that are very unfair to women, that are very unfair to religious minorities, and that are very unfair to sexual minorities. So again, it's about rights. And then also for me as a writer, and as someone who appreciates freedom of expression in all forms, I mean, I spray-painted a racist ad in New York a couple of weeks ago,
yeah.
but I will mention
we'll
it later.
That, yeah.
But I do appreciate freedom of expression, and I want to expand, not shrink, freedom of expression. So the cultural revolution in Egypt also must appreciate and embrace and open up to arts of all kind, cinema, arts, writing, poetry, mm-hmm. all of this, because I think that all of those different angles, freedom, the law, and the arts itself, is basically kind of standards and foundations of this cultural revolution.
Right. And so, speaking of different forms of expression, I noticed your tattoo.
Yes.
Could you tell me what that tattoo is?
Yeah, I have a picture on my right inner forearm of the ancient Egyptian goddess Sekhmet.
Uh-huh.
And she is the goddess of war and sex. As I often joke, often the same thing, war and sex. And I decided to have this tattoo because when I was healing after my arm and my hand were broken,
right,
and I spent, you know, weeks in casts and braces of various kinds, I determined that the way that I would celebrate survival and healing would be to dye my hair red. My hair is black. And because red is a fierce revolutionary uh-huh. color, and to get tattoos on both arms. I had never wanted tattoos before, but I wanted a tattoo for various reasons. Because I have a scar here from my operation, and it's a mark I did not choose to have on my body, but this is a mark I do choose. And also during the clashes where I was attacked, young boys as young as 12 would use Sharpies to write their mother's phone numbers on their forearms, knowing that they could die and end up in the morgue and no one would know who they
wow.
were. So this is a way of honoring that too, putting a marking on your body to honor, in this case, my heritage, ancient
right.
Egypt. And also the idea of loss and, you know, what did I lose when I was attacked in that way? I don't know. It's a very ephemeral kind of loss. But a tattoo can never be taken away from me. It's something that will stay with me forever. So it's a way to counter the idea of loss as well.
All right. And I want to a bit later go back to Egypt. But first, let's talk about what happened recently here in this country, in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
There was the spray painting incident when
mm-hmm.
there was a conservative group that put up a poster
mm-hmm.
in the New York subway. Mm-hmm. And could you explain that, start the story there?
Absolutely. It's a group that paid for an ad that said, and I quote, "In the war between the civilized man and the savage, always choose the civilized man. Support Israel, defeat jihad." And I consider this ad to be incredibly racist and bigoted.
And sponsored by?
By the American, I can't remember the exact name of the group, to be honest, but it's a group that is led by a woman called Pamela Geller, right, who was known, especially in New York, for her racism and bigotry.
Stop the Islamization of America.
That's one of her groups, but the group that put up this the ad that I protested against was called the American Defense Foundation or something like that.
Anti-Muslim American Freedom Defense Initiative.
Something like that. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And it's known for its racism and bigotry, as I said. And the reason I chose to protest this ad is because I consider it hate speech. Now, I don't want to ban hate speech, and the First Amendment does not ban hate speech. But I think that we need to connect the dots between hate speech and hate crime.
And what did you do?
So what I did was I took a can of pink spray paint, and I spray painted over this ad. And I chose pink because pink is the least violent of colors. Mm-hmm. But it's also see-through because I didn't want to cover the words. If I wanted to cover the words and censor that ad, I could have chosen black. But I chose pink because I wanted to be my expression over their expression and have people see the two expressions together. Right. Because the subway authority, the MTA, did not want to put these ads up. But this group took them to court and a judge ruled that it was protected political speech. So I wanted to see what I could do with my political speech and how protected it would be.
Right.
Now, I was arrested, and I recognized that
you were arrested during the woman who – from the representative of the group was
yes.
there. She was trying to stop you from
yes.
spray painting, and then the police showed up, and yes. they put you in cuffs and arrested you.
Yes. Yeah, she threw herself between me and the ad. She was from the group that sponsored this ad, and there was already media there because they were stationed across many subway stations because – posters had already been defaced with stickers that said racist and hate speech. So they were there protectively to anticipate any other protests.
And I imagine you put another tweet in there too about what was happening to you. Were you able to do that?
I tried to tweet. I actually did manage to tweet with handcuffs on, but the signal, the carrier signal at Times Square was really bad. So I did call from jail. One of the calls that I was able to make, I called a very good friend of mine, the veteran feminist Robin Morgan, and gave her my Twitter account info. So she was tweeting for me overnight because I was jailed overnight and I spent the night in central booking. Now, I was charged with criminal mischief, making graffiti, and possession of a graffiti instrument. I will go back before a judge on the 29th of November to see if I stand trial or not. But as I said, I wanted to highlight hate speech and connect it to hate crimes. And it was shown to me, actually, very tragically, the connection, because 5 days later, my brother's local mosque was set on fire.
Right.
It wasn't connected to my protest, but unfortunately, it was a reminder of the connection between hate speech and hate crimes. Mm-hmm. So as I said, I can't ban hate speech. I don't want to ban hate speech, and I don't want to ban racism or bigotry. But what I want to do is make them socially unacceptable. And Muslims, or those who appear to be Muslims in this country, appear to be basically one of the few groups left against whom it's acceptable to have an ad that calls us savage. And unless we make the connection between that kind of hate speech and the kind of attack on my brother's mosque, people will not understand how heinous that is. You right. can't say that about black Americans. You can't say that about Jewish Americans, and you shouldn't. You should also not be able to say that about Muslim Americans.
And there was also a mosque burning here in Missouri, down
yes.
in Joplin. I know you mentioned that in your tweets as well. The now, you are going to – and there was a pretty – strong reaction to what you did in New York City, and of support and of people who thought that you went too far.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of summarize the two sides and that mm-hmm. What they were saying about you and mm-hmm. and actually tweeting to you?
Sure. Those who supported me were, I think, mostly people who are fed up of inaction and just people tweeting about things that upset them and wanted to see something happen in the real world. And I was especially gratified to receive tweets of support and emails of support from young people, not just young Muslims, but young people generally, who, because of the revolutions that have happened, who, because of Occupy Wall Street, who, because of this kind of renewed sense of activism that they're seeing, mm-hmm. wanted everyone else to go out there and be as active and not to be so cynical and basically just kind of shrug and say, what can I do? And for young Muslims, it was also being fed up of being bullied.
Right.
It's 11 years since 9/11, and they're fed up of being told to apologize and basically being bullied into silence. Those who are against me belong to the right wing and the left. Mm-hmm. On the right, I've been called an Islamo-Nazi anti-speech ungrateful immigrant. So that's, you know, basically the, you know, racists and bigots from the right wing. Exactly. That's my new kind of T-shirt. But there were some people on the left who accused me of being attention-seeking and who wanted to, they thought I was doing this as a stunt and that I'd taken the media with me. And my response to them was, you know, the New York Post, who filmed this, are known to be anti-Muslim and anti-Arab, and there's no way that I could have agreed with them. Hey, guys, come and film me as I protest an, right, you know, a racist ad.
Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind all of our viewers that, and listeners, that you can find the program anytime by downloading our video podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. And please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@KBIA or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at our new handle at globaljourn, global J-O-U-R-N. Now, you said that you're going to go back to Cairo and spend more time there. Can you talk about what you're going to be doing and why you made that decision?
Yes, I mean, I made that decision because I've been going back to Egypt just about every month since I was attacked, because I just feel compelled to be there. When I'm there, I feel I'm in the center of the universe. I feel that I can contribute. It's very exciting to be there. This is the most exciting time of my life. It's something that myself and many people have dreamed of, this revolution of finally freeing ourselves from various kinds of dictatorships. So in that way, I'm very excited to be on the ground there. But I also want to turn this essay that you mentioned that I wrote for Foreign Policy into a book, looking at women's rights across the region and making kind of writing like a rallying cry, you know, recognizing our long and proud feminist heritage in Egypt. We've had in Egypt is just one of the many countries that has a long feminist history, but we had a feminist movement in Egypt since 1923 that a lot of people are unaware of. So honoring that feminist movement, but also kind of pushing it and seeing how we can push it to as a way of supporting the cultural revolution. I also want to help start a national campaign against sexual violence, to take what happened to me and channel it into something that could help other women who are also survivors of sexual assault. So I'll be working with a feminist group on the ground there called Bahia Masr, and with them and other activists on the ground, trying to make this kind of very, very broad and multifaceted campaign. You know, I imagine things like soccer stars helping us with billboards that say real men don't rape, real men don't beat, that kind of stuff, to offering women therapy if they need it for post-traumatic stress disorder, or free legal aid, or even free self-defense classes to help those who want to, you know, equip themselves with facing the outside world and any kind of sexual violence.
Have you always been this outspoken? Tell me about your childhood. And is it Port Said?
I was born in Port Said, but my family's from Cairo.
From Cairo.
Yeah.
And when did you first notice that you wanted your voice heard?
I think when my family moved to Saudi Arabia, because I grew up in a very egalitarian family. You know, my parents met in medical school and they fell in love in medical school and married for love and then moved us to London so they could do their PhD in medicine. Mm-hmm. So I always grew up in a home where my brother and I were told that the very same expectations for both of us, you know, that we couldn't even think about getting married, for example, until we finished university, and knowledge was always emphasized. And so it was a kind of Islam and a kind of culture that we grew up with in which there was no difference between the boy and the girl. And then we moved to Saudi Arabia, where it was a very different kind of Islam and culture, that there was a huge difference between being female and being male. And it really shocked my system into that. I mean, I often say I was traumatized into feminism, because I realized when you moved, you know, we moved to Saudi Arabia from the UK, and as a teenage girl, that's a very, very big adjustment.
Right.
And I fell into a deep depression, and the only way that I could fight it was through feminism. So I think that really was kind of my first very young taste of an intellectual activism that then later became a more activism in the real world.
And what ages were you in Saudi Arabia?
From 15 to 21, so 6 years. And then from 21 to 33, I would visit 2 or 3 times a year. So I had a long connection to Saudi Arabia.
How did the rest of the women in your family adjust to that?
Well, at the time, it was just my mother and I. I have a sister now who was born there, but she was very young when she was there, so it wasn't such a struggle. My mother had a very fulfilling job. She was teaching medical school, so she loved her job, but, you know, she couldn't drive anymore. So she would often say that she felt that she moved to Saudi Arabia and was crippled, because in the UK she could drive. So it was a big adjustment for her, but I think she got a lot of fulfillment from teaching, because university in Saudi Arabia is segregated. All education is segregated from grade 1 to the end of university.
Wow.
So she was teaching the female medical students. My dad was teaching the male, but they had very fulfilling jobs. So I think in that sense, my parents have good memories of Saudi Arabia, but I think they also resented this very, very ultra conservative interpretation of our faith that was very alien to them. And it's not something that they grew up with or that they taught me and my brother.
So you, after the age of 21, where did you go from there?
And then I moved back to Egypt to study journalism at the American University in Cairo and to start practicing journalism, which I did in about 1989, 1990. And I spent most of the years, my journalism years in the Middle East with Reuters News Agency in Cairo and then Jerusalem, and then also reported for The Guardian through from many of the countries in the region.
And let's kind of jump ahead to your more recent involved with journalism. It seems like you have sort of gone all in on social media and left a lot of the traditional forms of journalism behind. Can you talk about that and why?
Yeah, I think that the move began in 2001, and I say it's because 9/11 killed objectivity for me. I spent 10 years as a news reporter who was very much wedded to this idea of objectivity, whether it really exists or not, you know, is it subject for a long discussion. But I told the students when I was giving a masterclass earlier today that even in the world of mainstream news reporting or mainstream media news reporting, there is a way to cover stories that are personally important to you and to highlight issues that are personally important to you that will help those who are frustrated with the traditional notions of objectivity. But 9/11 for me killed objectivity. So I moved to opinion writing. And I often call myself a writer now, not a journalist anymore, just to make that distinction. I don't do news. I don't do objectivity. I do opinion and bias. My biases are very clear. And then with social media, I think it was when Facebook and then came along, I spent a lot of time on Facebook. But then Twitter came along and it was really essential with the revolutions especially because it connected me to people on the ground, but also people who could analyze the revolutions and who were often not consulted with in mainstream media stories. So it became an alternative news source for me, Twitter did, and also an alternative platform for me to share opinions. So because I'm an independent freelance journalist that doesn't have institutional backing, I often say Facebook and Twitter are my institutional backing because as a freelancer, that's the way that I can get my voice out and have people hear me.
How many people are following you?
On Twitter now, I think it's almost 165,000. And on Twitter, my personal account is capped at, I think, 5,000 because you can't go above 5,000. Right. And my page, I think, is now 15,000.
How do you deal with that volume of tweets? I'm just,
I know. That's why I live on Twitter.
Yeah. Right.
You know, Twitter has really taken me away from Facebook. I don't spend as much time on Facebook as I used to, and I feel bad for the people who do try to follow me on Facebook, but Twitter is just so immediate. It needs my attention throughout the whole day. I try to go back on Facebook every now and then. It can be very difficult to keep up with Twitter, and people often are frustrated that I don't reply to everybody, that it becomes impossible to reply to everybody. So I try to reply as often as possible. And when I'm attacked, I depending on the attack, I will often curse and then block people. Mm-hmm. Or I will leave some of the attacks on there and or retweet them and have other people respond. So I try to kind of act as some kind of help people along the way, but it's impossible for me to respond to everything. So, and also to maintain my sanity, every now and then I take a few days off Twitter. It's very difficult, but I'm trying.
Now, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Mona El-Tahawi. Mona, how can people follow you?
Well, the best way would be Twitter, which is at Mona El-Tahawi, and that's my first and last name exactly as it's spelt on news stories and columns and stuff. And I'm on Twitter, as I said, all day, so come see me sometime.
Okay, thank you. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
This episode of Global Journalist originally aired on October 25th, 2012.